The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by Exchange Wire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, research lead at Exchange Wire, and I'm delighted to be joined by this week's special guest, who is Chris Legaspi, VP of Commercial at Archipelago Hotels. Hello to you, Chris.
Hello, hello, good evening from Manila.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. And finally back on UK soil, it's Rachel Smith, CEO at ExchangeWire. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hello, Matt. Hello, Chris. Yes, it's quite nice to be back in Europe working during daylight hours, as both as both Chris will know from being in the Philippines at the moment, and Rodney, our sound engineer, who's in Bali. You guys are doing what I call the night shift. So getting ready to go to bed after you finish this piece of work.
Exactly.
Truly international podcast today. We'll dive straight in so we can give everyone an early night. And the first news story is that Spotify has announced that it will be launching music videos for premium users across 11 markets. The beta version began rolling out on Wednesday with a limited catalogue of videos from a range of artists. So my first question to you, Rachel, is how will this impact the music streaming landscape?
So the first thing I thought when I read this story is that it's a fantastic idea, I think, for Spotify to be running music videos alongside their music streaming service. The reason is because already, because music videos are so engaging is the first reason. So I think they're a great product for any music appreciators. And I think that if Spotify do well with, running a good volume of music videos on their site for premium customers, then I think other music streaming providers will be looking to do something similar and compete. Secondly, I like that it's kind of competing somewhat with the YouTube market. I'm certainly a very regular user, daily user of Spotify. I love it. I'm a less frequent user of YouTube. And because I'm such a regular user of Spotify, the idea that music videos would be available there where I'm already listening to music is very appealing to me. And then thirdly, I just think that Spotify have already got quite a lot of nice visual features associated with their mobile app, that such that if you are a regular user, it's really easy to get engaged into either the lyrics or, some of the sort of, cover art that they might have that provides a bit of a backdrop for any of the songs or the albums that you might be listening to. And I feel like this is just a natural progression from there onwards. So I'm sort of from a very happy user of Spotify's point of view, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great product. On the music streaming business side of things, I've already said that I think if it goes well, and what I mean by that is if Spotify managed to, get the rights to show these music videos, a high volume of music videos to their premium customers, then I think it will become a highly competitive market because it will suddenly set the benchmark for what users expect with a premium, ads-free streaming package, music streaming package service. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how that unfolds. And, I also think that it's going to mix things up, as I said earlier on, for YouTube, because I think that probably is really the go-to place where lots of people consume their music videos these days. I mean, maybe other social media platforms as well, but anything sort of longer form, longer than a few seconds, and you'll wind up on YouTube or another video platform. So I think this is really exciting because it mixes it up a bit, puts a bit more hands back into, sorry, puts a bit more power back into the hands of the music streamer versus the video platform. And I think that's kind of quite exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, the first time I read about this, I felt like finally Spotify has this. It's a welcome relief. At the same time, I'm very happy that the selected countries where it will be tested or be live right now includes Indonesia and Philippines, where I normally am most of the time. So that's a very good thing. Also, I like it because it is only available to subscribers, to premium members. Because of that, it would also give well, we hope that Spotify would actually load very nice videos, because it's only available to premium members. Unlike when it's available to free members, it probably is just going to be any video whatsoever is available, they're just going to be loading it. So I like the fact that it's available only for premium members.
Interesting. I had a brief trawl through my Spotify account earlier, trying to find a song that had a music video. Eventually found one, and the UX is quite smooth. It was smoother than I thought it would be, in terms of, you know, getting that kind of high quality music watching experience. Rachel, you touched on it earlier, but Chris, and, you know, how could it potentially affect YouTube's dominance within the music video market?
Well, this is the thing, because, well, the subscribers of YouTube is about 200 million, but the paid subscribers of YouTube is less than the paid subscriber of Spotify. So I think primarily Spotify is number one in terms of premium membership or premium subscribers. So in that specific market segment, I don't think it's going to affect much, right? But of course, for the especially because the music videos are not available to free subscribers of Spotify anyway. So I think it caters to a different market segment versus what the free subscribers of YouTube is catering to.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right on that front, Chris. I think what I was thinking of when I was thinking this will potentially provide a bit of competition for YouTube is just that it will hit users that are currently non-subscribers of YouTube and not mm-hmm. high-level users of YouTube. You know, I think those potential new customers that YouTube could be harnessing will now be quite happily catered for in the Spotify platform. Mm. But like you say, like you rightly point out with your marketing hat on, we might be talking about two different, you know, completely different customer bases. But I wonder if it will also affect the way that YouTube try to market their premium service to other users, and maybe they might think about what they actually make available as part of the premium paid for subscription. And I think they'll be watching closely and intently to see how well the video function takes off on Spotify, and whether on the flip side of it, it is also something that encourages more premium subscriptions. Because, you know, I'm imagining, especially in a region like Asia, Southeast Asia in particular, such a mobile dominant region with a very young population demographic, it might be that consumption of music videos is really popular amongst young people. Those mm-hmm. that are perhaps, you know, fortunate enough to be in a good economic position and part of an emerging middle class and ready to pay for subscriptions, it might be the thing that pushes them over the line and they think, oh yeah, I'm going to pay for a Spotify subscription now because I can get all my music videos there and it's a good user experience. And over time, maybe I can get more music videos there than I can get elsewhere. It'll be interesting to see what happens with licensing.
Yes. I agree because the game here, though, is that if Spotify can really bring in more quality videos in their platform, because I mean, if it's also available in the free subscription of YouTube, probably a lot of people will just go to YouTube and watch it. But if the Spotify would manage to secure those high quality ones and load these videos only for the premium subscribers, then that's going to be fantastic for Spotify.
Yeah,
100% agree. In terms of whether, you know, this video offering, obviously it's only on that premium tier at the moment, would Spotify potentially be tempted? Obviously, there's a lot of interest around video advertising at the moment and the high CPMs it attracts. Would they be tempted perhaps to roll out, you know, video adverts to that free tier to help entice them and get further brands interested in their platform?
I think it's a good question, right? Having been a premium user of Spotify for so long, I'm sort of not really up to speed with what the advertising experience is like on Spotify anymore. The last time I heard it, it was still very much like audio radio style advertising. Feels as though, like I said, because the app interface is very engaging these days. Admittedly, I'm not mostly looking at it. I'm mostly toggling through songs, either just with the, you know, remote control function on my phone or my headphones or whatever. But whenever I do look at it, it's a really pleasing, pleasant experience. So if I was a free user and I caught, you know, and I started watching videos there and then I would think it would be a great environment in which to be showing me video ads. And if I was a, you know, if I was an advertiser that liked to spend money in video ads, Spotify, even the free version, is a premium environment, I'd think.
Yeah, completely agree with that. But again, also, you know, the question is, would the free users of YouTube move to Spotify just in case, especially now that, let's just say, Spotify starts offering commercials or advertisements in its free environment? Again, that would be a welcoming thought, but at the same time, if there will be differences on the advertisements being shown on Spotify, that would also be very lovely. If they would be adapting to, let's just say, they already know that this user is more interested in certain types of music and would show advertisements that's related to the likes of this person. So that would be a welcoming thought, actually. And that's something different that Spotify can actually offer.
Yeah, bringing that audio contextual piece of video advertising sounds an interesting prospect. But we'll move it on to our second news story of the week now. And that's that the Indonesian Ministry of Communication and Information gave warnings on the 5th of March to 6 foreign-owned online travel agents that are not yet registered as private electronic system providers. They were given 5 working days to register. Otherwise, they could face punitive measures, including a block. So my question to you, Chris, is how could this impact advertisers in the APAC region and the wider travel market?
Okay. First of all, when I read the news, it's basically for Indonesia. And Agoda and Airbnb apparently already registered so far. Now, we need to understand that in Indonesia, there are very strong local OTA players as well. You have Traveloka, you have Ticket.com and the like. And when we say strong, they cater to immediately about 40 to 50% of the market, local market. What does this mean? So in terms of advertisement for hotels like us, for example, just in case it happens that the rest are not available for us for advertisements, we still have the bigger players, the local big players to advertise in. And to be very honest with you, because of there's very strong domestic business as well in Indonesia, this is quite okay. Now, the question only is, when I read the news, is that when they're banned, does that mean that, for example, I'm in Singapore, does that mean that I cannot see the Indonesian products in these platforms? Right? Because if they can still show, for example, from Singapore POS or point of sale, the Indonesian hotels can still be shown, I'm sure we can still advertise in that platform, in that POS or point of sale. Now, if the government will also not allow them, for example, these OTAs to show any of the Indonesian hotels outside Indonesia, then that's another story altogether.
Mm. And you wonder how that would be possible, though. I mean, because it would be really preventing businesses in Indonesia attracting international customers. And surely the Indonesian government doesn't really have a desire to do that. As much as they want to control these international companies and platforms, surely one of their main goals is to ensure the economic prosperity of Indonesia.
Yes. Basically, I think the government is doing this for compliance, of course, right?
Yeah.
Because about data privacy and, of course, the taxation and all of that, which for business people like us, of course, that's something that is all right. However, reaching other markets because using or via these platforms, of course, that would be challenging if and only if Indonesia perhaps really put together exactly how they would like to implement this. But as of right now, I really didn't read anything about Indonesian hotels not being able to be shown in these platforms outside Indonesia.
Yeah. I mean, I also thought when I read this story that it was an interesting, there was a few other interesting examples in this story of some of the measures that the Indonesian government is trying to undertake to both protect local industries, so, you know, restore certain standards for local OTAs and global OTAs trying to operate in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. But then also I thought the piece of the story that focused on the government trying to implement requirements for the likes of Google and Meta to pay for news publishing items was really interesting. And this is something the Australian government implemented over in Australia in 2020. Unfortunately, yes. It has now stalled because Google and Facebook made some negotiations with Australian news publishers that have now come to the end of their term, the contractual term, and they're saying they're not willing to renew it. But anyway, the principle being that the government is trying to protect local industries. Yes. So the main yes. crux of this story is the OTAs, but the few extra points raised in this story is about the government trying to protect news publishers and Indonesian news publishers. And then yes. there's one final bit about, wasn't it to do with goods over $100 and some restrictions around how those goods could be marketed and sold. So that to me is really interesting. And would we have read that accurately, do you think, Chris? Is it the government trying to protect industries within Indonesia, or is it more about data privacy control of what's happening within the country?
So one of the definitely number one is protecting the interests of the local players, yeah. And of course the hoteliers. At the same time, there's data privacy issues as well, as one of the things that they've written in the articles that I've read. But also, you know, what's good about the government of Indonesia is that while they really think carefully about these things, by the way. So while there are restrictions that they may put just to protect everybody, remember there's always Google as well. So in terms of advertisement, we can all go to Google and do our advertisements depending on the countries that we want to promote our hotels to. We're all free to do that still.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. And it's a really, you know, they've, in terms of the approach the Indonesian government has taken, it's already paid off in the sense that obviously they were looking at TikTok earlier in the year on that e-commerce front, and it led to a massive $1.5 billion investment in a local player. So do you guys think that, you know, we can expect other APAC or other global nations go for that more hardline approach against, you know, foreign-owned technology providers to ensure that their local providers are in the driving seat?
I find it really interesting because the TikTok ban followed by the Tokopedia acquisition, I thought felt like an Indonesian power play, because let's not forget this is a country with an enormous population and a really far-reaching archipelago of islands as well. So it's also geographically large in a way that other geographically large countries aren't. So sometimes I think people overlook that fact if they're not very familiar with the region. They think of it as a collection of smallish Southeast Asian countries, and it's neither of those things, both in terms of population or in terms of, you know, geography that it covers. And I felt as though it was partly the Indonesian government implementing something that says, you know, if you want to come and compete in this local economy and sell things to our population, because we've got such a huge population, which is very young, emerging middle class, then you have to play by our rules, I'm afraid. And that's exactly what happened with TikTok and Tokopedia, right?
That's right. And, you know, I have friends, of course, in different countries within Southeast Asia, and a lot of them would like to, how they wish that their countries can be like Indonesia in terms of how they protect the interests of the local economy, making sure that as mentioned, these international players would follow our rules in this side of the world. Because long and short of it, if we do not control, there would be abuse, of course, in so many levels. And this is exactly why the government of Indonesia is protecting the economy. Mm.
Absolutely. And that's a beautiful point to lead us into the final news story of the week. And that's that the European Parliament has approved the world's first comprehensive law regarding AI. The AI Act classifies products according to risk and adjusts scrutiny accordingly. AI models will be regulated based on their capacity to harm society. Rachel, how positive is this legislation for the AI industry as a whole?
So we've been talking quite a lot over the last sort of 6 months or so about the need for some sort of legislative regulation and control to do with use and application of AI tools. obviously use and application of AI tools is an extremely, you know, loose umbrella term, because there's lots of different AI tools and lots of different applications of AI, both within marketing and advertising, which is our main concern on this podcast, but also just across society. So on the one hand, my initial feeling is good to start seeing some regulation coming through. But then on the other hand, it very much depends on how that regulation and legislation is crafted. For whose benefit is it crafted, and what is the impact going to be on both individuals and, you know, users of services that might be powered by AI, and also industries that might rely on some of the fantastic innovative things that AI can achieve. So yes, to some form of regulation and legislation, it's absolutely needed, and it's abundantly clear that it's going to be a requirement for all countries going forward, because AI is most certainly, most applications involving AI are accelerating far beyond our point, our ability to keep up with them, and our and the point of understanding that we've currently got. So we definitely need to sort of speed up, but because of the pace at which the industry is unfolding when it comes to developing AI tools, I do worry a bit about who's making these legislative recommendations, or that are becoming enshrined in law and then becoming regulations. Mm. Because as an industry, as a marketing and advertising industry, we've been through this before with GDPR, right, and any privacy laws. In theory, protection of consumers' rights is essential, critical, fundamental human rights, and that therefore includes protection of people's personal data and user data. All of that sort of thing should be overseen and should be structured and controlled, but not at the behest of innovation, change, competition, you know, competitive, thriving marketplace and industry that enables consumer choice and, you know, good quality products for reasonable prices. So you want to see a mix and a balance of all of that. And although AI might not necessarily immediately be directed to monetizable products with respect to marketing and advertising, it's becoming so integrated in many of the things that we do. For a start, machine learning is certainly the foundation of the advertising technology industry. We do need to make sure that the people that are putting forward recommendations for legislative changes know what they're doing and understand the consequences of what they're doing. I like the risk-based system. It sounds good in theory, but as ever, the devil is in the detail. Exactly what do those risk tiers correlate to? Do they go far enough? Do they go too far? We need to spend a bit more time looking at that and debating that. And like GDPR, it needs to get tested, right? It needs for a business or an individual to put their hand up and say, hang on a minute, either this isn't being, you know, this particular piece of legislation is being largely ignored by commercial industries, or this piece of legislation isn't going far enough and isn't doing, you know, isn't hitting the sentiment it was intended to hit.
Absolutely. Chris, how do you think that balance is going to be struck?
Yes, so agree completely. It is dependent on how it will be written and how it would be regulated. And yes, definitely the impact of this will be in innovation. As it is right now, because there's no regulation and there's really no written law about it, everybody's just trying to invent something new, right? Be innovative. And some crazy ideas suddenly become very useful and very, very, I mean, useful in everything, basically. But I must agree that there are certain AIs also that I feel like can be risky in terms of security, because I see some AIs wherein they already copy biometrics already and they use faces, etc. And now you don't even know which are real photos, for example. I mean, if two people actually kiss or they were not even together, for example. So a lot of things indeed are coming out, which I think there should be some regulations that has to be put in place somehow. But the essence of being innovative, or the innovation concept or innovation part of all of this creation of new AI, should be protected. Because otherwise, if the innovation itself is being controlled eventually, then we'll probably go back to where we were before pre-COVID, where we didn't have all these things.
100%. Or it may lead to the kind of anti-competitive market that has sprung up in some technology sectors simply because the innovation has been limited to those big players who have the resources to do it. You touched on it earlier, Rachel, but how could this legislation affect the use of AI within advertising as a sector individually?
So I think from memory of looking at the article and having a quick look over the tiers of risk, I think it was sort of a very high risk to fundamental human or individual rights, then high risk activities and services, and then low risk activities and services. Most of what we'd be talking about in marketing and advertising are going to probably fall within the high risk and low risk group and not the extreme risk group. You would hope not. And so therefore, we're talking mostly about data management and control, copyright control, and accuracy, I suppose, accuracy of images and information, which at the extreme level becomes, handling and dealing with misinformation, especially when it becomes harmful. So I think for the marketing and advertising industry, in a way, this could be, a much more useful opportunity to oversee some of the things that we're currently doing to manage and control data, to make it more usable, to ensure that we're protecting individuals' rights and privacy, but potentially enabling us to speed up the actual process of using and applying data within marketing and advertising. So what I hope is that we're going to see AI tools that will help on the efficiency front and improve perhaps the creative process, whether that's actually the efficiency element of it and or the actual creative output. And I would hate to see regulation get in the way of any of that, because I think some of that stuff is definitely at the cornerstone of innovation in our industry at the moment. Exactly as Chris mentions, it's crazy concepts that people have come up with that have actually become quite useful for marketers, and we wouldn't want to stamp on that innovation, because it would just be a shame. I think all the nefarious purposes for which we could think about, for which could be associated with misuse of AI, hopefully have got nothing to do with marketing and advertising. Hopefully that's a whole other world away. As Chris says, scraping biometric data to create fresh identities or to, create images and, that are false and construct scenes that haven't actually happened. All of that sort of stuff could be incredibly distressing, but I hope it's far away from marketing and advertising.
Yeah, you definitely hope so. Chris, how are you using or at least exploring AI at Archipelago, and how do you think that maybe the company will use it going forward within their advertising efforts?
Yeah, well, in the hotel business, AI basically has been there for a long time. However, it wasn't called AI back in the days, right? So all of this data gathering, all of this machine learning has always been there. But the difference though now in terms of it has, a new set of AIs are now available for us in terms of marketing, right? Things that, for example, as easy as content development. Once upon a time, especially in Southeast Asia, we definitely need help on these things. And before, for example, if you are describing 5 similar rooms of the hotels, it probably would take us, an entire month to describe those 5, to create different content for those 5 rooms. As opposed to now, there are fabulous AIs available that would help us make this task be completed in a shorter span of time. Probably 5-10 minutes. So we can move on and do something else and develop some more products for our guests, for example. So yeah, it has been helping us a lot. Now, another thing that AI has been helping us which I think is related to this EU AI Act, is the transparency and accountability, for example. We use AIs like Perplexity, for example, where specifically they would show us exactly where they got the information. So these things helps us create better materials and truthful materials for our guests, for example.
That's really interesting.
It is really interesting. And that's exactly the sort of stuff that, you know, you would want to make sure continues to be accessible to everyone working in the hotel industry. You'd like to see, you know, those sort of technical solution providers continue to innovate on those products and tools and solutions, because it's really going to drive greater efficiencies for the industry and also create better experiences, better customer experiences. Yes. And as we know, hotel travel in general, but hotels especially, it's all about that, you know, that wonderful customer experience. We all know what it's like when you have a hotel or resort experience that's, you know, impeccable. And then we all know what it's like, yes, when it's absolutely awful. And if some of that, yep, is associated with things like traveler friction that could have been resolved using AI tools, I mean, I want to, yes, live in the AI world. Thank you.
It's a wonderful soundbite to end things on. But Chris, it's been absolute pleasure to have you on board with us.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. And thank you very much, Rachel, as well, for having me tonight and today there in your side of the world.
International podcast. And Rachel, pleasure for you to join us as ever.
Yes, thank you very much. Really enjoyed it. It's been like having a nightcap cup of tea with Chris before he heads off to bed.
And with that, we'll say good night and thank you for listening to this week's Mad Tech Podcast.